This is CBSi in the World. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gatestone Newsweek in the Hill. We go immediately to Singapore to our colleague Fraser Howie. He is the co-author of Red Capitalism, to comment on two international meetings these last weeks, the G20 in Rome and the COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland. We begin with the G20 and an endorsement of the global minimum tax of 15%. 130 nations or more have joined in this idea of everyone charging a minimum. Therefore, there's no competition among what are called tax havens. Fraser, a good day to you. All politics are local. Singapore. Singapore has a corporate tax rate of 17%, which sounds okay if the global minimum is 15. But I learned that there are opportunities for investors that can reduce the rate to as low as 4%. How does Singapore plan to deal with this agreed upon but not enforceable recommendation for 15% globally? Good day to you.
Good day, John. Look, I think they obviously need to be supportive. They're a small country that depends on international business flows, but I'm also sure that they are busy thinking of ways and looking at ways that they can still remain competitive and be a good place for business to attract companies. Of course, one of the things working in their favor, perhaps unlike some of the Pacific Island states or even the Caribbean states, is that Singapore is largely in the center of one of the most dynamic regions in the world. It is a nice place to live. It has good travel links. So that it isn't just a case of putting your black brass plaque on a shack door and saying this is the global headquarters of my international banking group or accountancy group or whatever. You can actually have a real sort of physical presence and do business in Singapore. And so that will keep Singapore, I think, competitive. But clearly this works against places which have traditionally has sold themselves on low taxes.
Gordon, you have a question for Fraser.
Low taxation would seem to be good for economic development and for prosperity in general. Do you think it's a good idea for the G20 to impose this idea of a global minimum tax?
I'm not a tax lawyer, I think, but I am a taxpayer. And I think there are genuine concerns about levels of deficit, the spending on the back of COVID. Things like healthcare, aging societies. I think, if you were running the government and running the country, these are difficult challenges, and the feeling that large corporates can come and by clever use of tax havens basically do a lot of business in your country and not pay very much tax directly as the corporate, not their employees paying their tax, which is often the claim they make. I think that you can certainly see why action's required. Is this the right action? That I'm not in a position to say, but I can certainly see why a lot of people and a lot of the middle classes are saying, sort of enough's enough, that we pay our taxes and we feel that large corporations are not.
I'm looking at a photograph of the Quirinal Palace in Rome, gathered around an enormous rectangle with the chandeliers lit, are the leaders of the G20s and their colleagues, all looking in quite manicured and presentable. But I do not see Vladimir Putin, nor do I see Xi Jinping. And we go to Glasgow for COP26, and neither did I see in the photographs Vladimir Putin of Russia and Xi Jinping. Is this a significant fact for Singapore, for the business of South Asia, that those two Eurasian leaders did not show up?
Well, I think it's not just a fact for Singapore. I think it's for the globe, that you've got two, certainly when it comes to climate change, two countries which are right at the forefront of this are at the sharp end, and they're largely missing in action. Vladimir Putin, I think, is always a bit of a mischief maker. I think few look to him for global leadership. But certainly the Chinese see themselves as being a global leader and see their position, as in their mind, I hasten to add, that America is in decline and the natural leader to come is China. Well, they may think that, and I think they're wrong, but what I'm certain about is that you don't become a global leader by staying at home. And that if Xi Jinping basically needs to sell his China story because they don't have very good PR, he needs to be out there, and he's missing in action, both at G20 and when it comes to COP26.
Gordon?
Fraser, so why do you think that Xi Jinping has skipped both of these meetings in Europe?
Sure, I think there's a number of reasons. Almost all of them are sort of very domestic in focus. I think he has a genuine fear of COVID. He doesn't want to catch it. He doesn't want to be in the quarantine for 3 weeks when he gets back. He doesn't want to be seen to getting special treatment. Remember, he is a leader who has his own food. You know, his senior party communist leaders have their own food prepared in special organic gardens. He is literally not even breathing the same air as the regular man in the street in China. So he certainly doesn't want to expose himself to COVID. So he has that concern. He has, there is an inward turn domestically within China, both ideologically and economically. He does not want to put himself in the path of criticism of other world leaders in terms of his domestic policies, his lack of transparency around COVID. And I think because of that as well, his domestic policies, he's basically picked fights with many of his neighbors and with the United States, which is a very stupid thing to do. And I think to some extent his position domestically is probably not as strong as many people think. That while he appears to have a lot of strength and the strongest leader since Mao, at the same time, I think he's in a relatively fragile position, and he certainly doesn't want to be leaving the country. He's probably worried about what mischief could happen if he's not there.
There have been headlines over many weeks, Fraser, you know very well, about U.S. companies leaving or no longer investing or doubting whether there is any future in working in China. Is that true for other countries in South Asia, for Singapore, for Indonesia, for Australia? Is there a hesitation about investing or participating in China business?
It's probably coming, but it's slower. I often think that that some of those concerns seem to percolate very slowly through Asia. And from that perspective, those concerns aren't as forceful at the moment. I think they will come. But at the moment, there's still a feeling that China is a place to do business. Although COVID restrictions, have put everything on hold, that people simply aren't getting to China. So very difficult to see how you conduct business when you can't even get there.
So right now, you would say that a decision has not been made, that they're observing the news from the U.S., but they have not made a decision for themselves.
I think that's right. I think they see this as still a U.S. sort of problem, or a Western sort of problem. They don't really see it as an Asian problem yet. Although I think that's just because their lack of thinking and thinking further down the line, that the problems that the U.S. is facing are ultimately Asia's going to need to be choosing, or they're going to run into similar problems with the Chinese themselves.
Gordon, do I say correctly that there is an obvious hesitation and reluctance and turning around and going the other way of American businesses on mainland of China? Is that accurate, Gordon?
I think that there is the reluctance. There's concern. Oftentimes, American companies won't say this out loud because they don't want to anger the Chinese government. But right now, you can see it. LinkedIn has left. Yahoo News decided to go. Epic Games took one of its important offerings out of China. So really, this is something which is basically being driven by Beijing. And American companies, again, are trying to stay there, but sometimes Beijing leaves them no choice.
You have a question for Fraser.
Fraser, how do people in Singapore and elsewhere in the region view the Evergrande crisis in China and its effect on the Chinese economy and financial system?
Very little overseas impact at the moment, Gordon, in terms of that property concern and real crisis in China. There's no sort of knock-on effect into Southeast Asia. As yet, there's nothing to see there, and I think the impacts are going to be relatively limited. I think, though, that people are looking on, and everybody is sort of slowly waking up to the reality that the China economy is not a miracle economy. It's not defeating the laws of economics, that they have built growth on tremendous debt, and those debts are coming due. And in the case of Evergrande, they can't afford to pay them.
Fraser, COP26 is about climate change. China contributes, along with India, the bulk of the fossil fuels. Is that a serious discussion to your measure throughout South Asia, that China is powered by what is castigated?
Look, I think there's a couple of factors which tells you a lot about Southeast Asia and COP26. The only G20 leader who went to Rome but didn't go on to Glasgow was Singapore's Lee Hsien Loong. Okay, now this is a country with a lot of low-lying areas and certainly in the crosshairs of climate change. And then Indonesia, literally, the president signed up a COP to stop deforestation by 2030. The next day, the domestic politicians back in Jakarta are saying, no, that's unfair, we can't do it. So there's a lot of denial, there's a lot of focus on economic growth, and not really understanding the model has changed, that the world has changed.
Fraser Howey, co-author of Red Capitalism, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Nash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.